Good morning, Santa Fe. Welcome to Wake Up Call, your source in the morning for the world of Northern New Mexico at KSFR 101.1 FM. I'm Tom Trowbridge, and coming up on the program on this Thursday, December 28th, 2017, the news about local musician Bonnie Hearn's death on Tuesday hit many Santa Fe residents hard. And coming up, KSFR's Ellen Lockyer speaks with a longtime friend of Bonnie Hearn's, Jenny Kimball.
You put a mic in front of her, and the tenor of her voice, it was just like a songbird. It just made you stop in your tracks.
Also ahead on Wake Up Call this morning, the Marketplace Morning Report, plus a KSFR local news update, then a story about a great way for you to launch the new year at many New Mexico state parks the first day of 2018.
This is our sixth year in a row that we've been hosting first day hikes throughout 13 of our state parks throughout New Mexico. So we have parks in the south, parks in the east, parks in the west, and parks in the north that are celebrating New Year's Day with a first day hike, and also some polar bear plunges.
Brr, makes me cold early this morning just thinking about the idea. But that's Christina Cordova with the New Mexico State Parks Division, and she'll fill us in on what the New Mexico State Parks are offering as an invigorating way to launch the new year. But first, some positive news in New Mexico about what's been a major battle over the years. On Wednesday, the New Mexico Department of Health announced that the state's drug overdose death rate improved from 8th highest in the nation in 2015 to 12th highest in 2016. The New Mexico Department of Health's Substance Abuse Epidemiology Section Head, Dr. Laura Tometi, calls the news very exciting.
As long as we've been measuring drug overdose, we have been in the top 10. We were number one for decades. Then we slipped down to two and three. Last year, we were at 8th highest in drug overdose in the nation, and now we're 12th highest in the nation. 13th if you count in District of Columbia. So this is the first time that we've been out of the top 10, which is wonderful news and very heartening. And the other sort of flip side of that coin, unfortunately, is that our rate hasn't decreased. our rate has really sort of plateaued in the last few years. Whereas other states, especially in the eastern part of the country, have really seen dramatic increases in the past few years and have overtaken our rate. And so while our ranking is going down, and that is excellent news that we should definitely celebrate, it will also be very exciting when our rate goes down, which hasn't happened quite yet.
Yeah, that was my other question, was is New Mexico standing in this category because other states are getting worse? And I guess you just answered that by saying yeah.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, I mean, it would, you know, we definitely would like to, we'd like to start seeing some real decreases in our drug overdose death rate here.
There have been steps taken by the Martinez administration that has that have been taken, and I was wondering if you think any of these are responsible for at least keeping our rate static, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to say for sure. I mean, it's always really hard to you know, definitely point to one silver bullet, you know, that's really been protective for our state. But I do think that there's been a lot of really great work done, and I think that a lot of, you know, strengthening the prescription monitoring program and providing naloxone, expanding access to naloxone, expanding access to medication-assisted treatment, you know, these are all really effective interventions. And I think, you know, New Mexico's really gone after a lot of those interventions, and I think has really stood out in how hard we've worked on those interventions. And so I do think that we should definitely celebrate that we have been doing a lot of really good work, and I do think that that good work is at least keeping our rates from increasing a whole lot. You know, but I do think also there are some other factors. For example, in other states in the eastern part of the country, fentanyl has been a big contributor to their increases in their drug overdose death rates, and we really have not seen The same, we do have fentanyl deaths in New Mexico, deaths due to fentanyl here in New Mexico, however, not nearly to the same extent as other states, and we haven't been seeing the huge increases that other states have seen. So I do think that the interventions that, you know, we've been doing are really great, and I think are indeed effective. And I think, we also have new challenges like fentanyl.
What else should my listeners know, Laura, about this good news, relatively speaking, from New Mexico in terms of drug overdose deaths?
So we're trying to encourage anyone who uses an opioid and their friends and family to get naloxone. That it's a fairly safe medication that reverses an opioid overdose. We're encouraging all prescribers to check the prescription monitoring program before they prescribe a controlled substance, because the prescription monitoring program is an amazing database that then basically a prescriber can see their whole prescription history for their patient and make sure that their patient isn't getting sort of dangerous amounts or dangerous combinations of, like, for example, opioids and benzodiazepines. And we're also encouraging prescribers to consider becoming medication-assisted treatment providers, or MAT. So mid-level providers like nurse practitioners and physician's assistants can now get their X waivers, which allows them to prescribe Suboxone. We're really trying to expand access to MAT. And I think that this news is really exciting. And it will be even more exciting when our rate goes down.
Laura Tometi with the New Mexico Department of Health. KSFR's wake-up call time is 8:14. Ahead on wake-up call, the Marketplace Morning Report, then KSFR's Ellen Lockyer reports on Tuesday's passing of Santa Fe music legend Bonnie Hearn.
Some clarity from the IRS as some homeowners rush to prepay taxes.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by CDW. CDW Cloud Consulting can help your company develop smart strategic cloud solutions to maximize your cloud investment. CDW, people who get it.
From Marketplace in Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams, in for David Brancaccio. Homeowners in high-tax states and counties have been scrambling to prepay their 2018 property taxes. They're hoping to take advantage of a tax deduction before it shrinks under the new GOP tax law. But last night, the IRS threw a wrench in those plans. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra joins me with more. Marielle, first remind us what these homeowners were trying to do.
So when you file your federal tax return, you can deduct what you paid in state and local taxes, including taxes on your home if you own one. And that saves you money. But the new tax law caps that deduction at 10 grand. So homeowners are trying to squeeze in an extra deduction now. They've been lining up outside their county offices to prepay their taxes for 2018. And the plan is to deduct those taxes in April when we'll all still be paying under the old system.
And states and counties have been encouraging their residents to do this.
Yeah, Washington, D.C. posted instructions on its website. New York State and also counties in Maryland, California, Virginia have said their residents can prepay. The IRS put the brakes on all this in a statement last night. So every year, if you own a home, you get a property tax assessment. The time of year that happens depends on where you live. Now the IRS is saying if you don't get your 2018 property tax assessment by December 31st, then you can't go ahead and deduct your taxes early, even if you prepaid them. Robertson Williams, a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center, says this is going to be a problem in counties that don't do their assessments until the new year.
At this point, people can only guess what the taxes would be, and the IRS has said that's not good enough.
So, in other words, some residents in those counties just ponied up thousands of dollars to no avail. And Williams says it's up to those places whether to give people their money back.
Marketplace's Marielle Segarra, thanks. The IRS does say you can still make deductible contributions to charities and retirement accounts for this tax year. Let's do the numbers. The S&P is mostly flat this morning, up less than a point. The Dow is up 3 points, about 0.1%. The Nasdaq also up 0.1%. The FTSE in London is up just 3 points, essentially flat. We're also watching how the economy overall is doing at the tail end of the year. To help with that, I'm joined by Diane Swonk. She's CEO of DS Economics in Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with consumer confidence. It declined a bit in December.
It declined a bit in December. Actually, it's come off since October. The good news is much of that decline was people's expectations about the future, not their feeling about the economy today, which is our best indicator of how the economy is performing. In fact, one of the things that was very encouraging was how good the job market is still in the current indicator. So, yes, did come off a bit. The news cycle matters in those expectations, but the good news is people's current financial conditions continue to improve.
Which is probably why we saw holiday spending up this year.
It was a phenomenal holiday season. It saw the strongest gains at least since 2011, which was off a very weak 2010. And I talked to many retailers that are now saying they saw a record year. We saw people also spend online a lot, and the retailers kept their inventories in check. That is one of the reasons we saw such a good holiday season, was people actually had a nice tailwind of both employment gains, some income gains, and also we had some catch-up from the disasters earlier in the year.
But on the other hand, the savings rate is really low. Why do you think that is?
We're down to the lowest level since 2007 and broke that 3% threshold. Many people talk about what they call wealth effects, when they're willing to spend a lot more money because their home is worth more value than it was and their stock market holdings are worth more than they were, so they're willing to spend more of their disposable cash. Another reason, though, those disasters earlier in the year, everything from fires to storms, people are still replacing and repairing damaged property. The good news is that's given an extra lift to holiday spending for retailers. The bad news is we're all going to be paying for that in higher insurance costs. In fact, vehicle insurance already accelerated in the month of November in terms of what it costs to insure your car. That's going to be happening across the board.
Diane Swonk is CEO of DS Economics in Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson, EcoTank 2750 printer with up to 2 years of ink in the box for printing up to 5,000 pages. Cartridge-free printing with EcoTank. More information at Epson.com/EcoTank. And by T. Rowe Price. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price to find global investment opportunities. For 80 years, T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence.
After the BP oil spill in 2010, a new federal oversight agency was created, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, or BSEE. Now, that agency is proposing to roll back some of the safety rules it created. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which obtained the proposal. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff has more.
There are two major rules BSEE wants to rescind. The first requires that inspectors of critical equipment, like the blowout preventers that failed in the BP spill, be federally certified.
This is one of the key technical changes that have come about as a result of the BP tragedy.
Lori Epstein is with the Wilderness Society. She describes the second rule as the teamwork requirement. Deepwater oil workers have to live stream data back to shore for a double check. Nancy Levison of MIT helped write the presidential report on the BP spill.
The rules are critical and they're just basic. I mean, they are just the beginning of what they should be doing.
She says the oil industry sees these rules as unnecessary government overreach and too expensive. BSEE estimates they'll cost more than $900 million over a decade. Levison says, think bigger.
$900 million is a pittance of the $50 billion the BP paid after the accident.
She adds that other countries with offshore oil production, like Norway, have had such rules in place for years. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloff for Marketplace.
And we are checking in with American communities struck by man-made and natural disasters this year. Head over to Marketplace.org to hear about recovery efforts in Northern California, Texas, and Florida. It's also in our Marketplace podcast feed, including today's conversation with the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Tomorrow, we'll hear about one town's recovery in Puerto Rico. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American.
And good morning, it's 8:22. As we here at KSFR News have been relating the past day or so, iconic Santa Fe musician Bonnie Hearn died Tuesday at the age of 71. Bonnie Hearn and her husband Bill Hearn were originally from Texas and played a style of country and folk music that entertained New Mexicans for decades, playing at La Fonda in Santa Fe for the past 25 years. KSFR's Emma Mockyer spoke with La Fonda CEO Jenny Kimball about her relationship with Bonnie Hearn.
Well, I understand you knew Bonnie Hearn very well because she and her husband Bill had played at La Fonda for, well, you said 25 years.
25 years, yeah. We just had the party several months ago celebrating their anniversary of playing at La Fonda. So they played here a quarter of a century when you think about it. Pretty amazing.
Well, what is amazing to me is, first of all, they were both blind, or at least legally blind in Bill's case.
And yes.
How did you, were you there when they auditioned?
I was not here. I was a lawyer for La Fonda for 30 years, but I wasn't actually, I haven't been chairman of the board for 11, so I wasn't actually involved in the day-to-day until I came over. So I don't know that, but I am from Texas, and so I'd heard of Bill and Bonnie Hearn because they were Austin and from years and years and years. And then when I came, you know, I've known them probably 20 years maybe. And then clearly when I became chairman of the board of La Fonda, when the Ballins passed away, who were my predecessors, I got to know Bill and Bonnie very well. And, you know, when they needed a ride home, threw them in my car, including Bonnie had a service dog at that point, the dog. So I knew where they lived and loved listening to them and loved interacting with them. I think the most gracious things about Bill and Bonnie, despite their sight handicap and their just unbelievable talent and voice, was they were so appreciative of being able to play at La Fonda. I don't think a week would go by when I wouldn't see Bill and he would say, you know, oh, Jenny, we got another year and thank you for letting us play. It was like we were doing them such a favor letting them play here, which was clearly not the case because they were so talented. But I think that says a whole lot about Bill and Bonnie and how they interacted with life. It's just so appreciative and just so humble. I think the first time I saw them, we had a fabulous music venue in Santa Fe called the Paulo Solari on the Indian School. And since I'm from Texas, every time Lyle Lovett would show up in Santa Fe, I would go hear him play at the Paulo Solari. And I was sitting behind or in front of Bill and Bonnie, and we were laughing. And sure enough, Lyle Lovett calls them both up on the stage to play with him. And I'm like, wow, you know, that to me is country and western and Texas royalty to know Lyle Lovett and Lyle to know them by name. And so we just got to be friends and, you know, playing at the hotel. And Bonnie was just always so kind and gracious, but had a kind of a wicked, funny sense of humor. And I remember a couple of years back when we were getting a lot of grief about changing or renovating La Fonda, and there was some ugly letter to the editor to me about what I was doing to La Fonda. And the next week I saw Bonnie. She'd come in with a friend to have lunch in the restaurant. She pulled me aside. She said, Jenny, I didn't really want to tell you this, but I will. That person that wrote that horrible letter is one of my dear, dear friends, and you don't have to listen to her because she just complains and hates everything. So don't let it get to you. You're doing a great job. And I just thought, that was so sweet of Bonnie because I didn't know they were friends, and she owned up that the letter writer was a friend of hers, but then tried to make me feel good despite that, you know. So that's just kind of who Bonnie was.
Well, they certainly embodied a musical style that is so American tradition, but it seems to be dying out these days, but not with them. I mean, they're playing, they're singing, it's smooth, just smooth,
yeah,
as whiskey. Any particular stories other than one you just told about Bonnie that you could relate to our listeners?
Not really, other than just she was such an amazing talent and so humble about her talent. You know, but you put a mic in front of her and that the tenor of her voice, it was just like a songbird. It just made you stop in your tracks.
and the river she flows on around the bend.
You know, and as a couple, both of them so complimented each other in their musical style and talents, and that, you know, it's really amazing that they found each other and that they were able to produce music together so long until, you know, I don't know how many months it's been since Bonnie hasn't been, though I think Bill told me she was going to sing over Christmas at her church, so she was still singing. But other than the anniversary here, their 25th anniversary, you know, it's mainly been Bill and his band, and with Bonnie just coming to listen. But she's just was the most gracious, humble person, and I know Bill is devastated, and LaFonda is, because they've just been the Bill and Bonnie Hearn, you know, such a fixture for her for so long. We're just anxious to have Bill be able to come back and in with his band and play again, but you know, it's just not going to be the same for any of us, much, you know, for the LaFonda crowd. You know, we have people that come to hear them and to dance and have for 25 years. They've got such an amazing following, and you know, I can remember Bonnie and Bill always saying, you know, don't forget to tip the waitresses and your bartenders. They're the hardworking ones working for your tips, you know. So they were just always so gracious about LaFonda and about our staff and making sure that their followers didn't shortchange our staff or the bartenders. You know, they were just always thinking out, you know, looking out for other people, and just the most humble couple I've ever met. And you know, Bill, my heart just breaks for him. And we sometimes call us the LaFonda family, because we've got a lot of people that have worked here a long time, and I think all of us are just reaching out to Bill and grieving with him, because he and Bonnie have been part of the LaFonda family for 25 years now, and that's, you know, in this day and age, that's saying a lot. That's a lot of continuity and consistency.
Yeah, that is saying a lot. Well, they have left a wonderful music. Well, Bill is still going strong, but Bonnie has left a wonderful musical legacy.
Did you go to the Platinum Music Awards when they got there? It was it looked like a gold medal. They had these heavy, heavy, beautiful medals on ribbon that they were awarded this year at the first ever Platinum New Mexico Music Awards. And I'm so happy, especially now given Bonnie's passing, that they were able to be the recipients of that the first time ever. And when she was so healthy and with it and able to just be the belle of the ball with Bill getting those awards, that's just, I was thinking back on that and couldn't have been more proud. They did a beautiful video of their life, and it's a beautiful tribute to both of them and their talents.
And we definitely want to note her passing, and I do appreciate your comments.
Sure.
Anything else you want to say?
No, other than LaFonda is grieving totally all of us. As I said, I was at the hospital Christmas, and at any rate, it's hit us all.
But as long as we're here, the answer's clear. We'll dance in the New Mexico rain.
New Mexico rain.
It's hot down
New
in Texas.
Mexico rain.
I call this my home. If I ain't happy here, then I ain't happy nowhere.
New Mexico rain when my mind starts to roam.
City. 32 minutes now after 8 o'clock on KSFR's Wake Up Call. Ahead, KSFR's local news. And in the second half, we'll hear about a great way to start the new year at many New Mexico state parks. Stick around. Now, KSFR Local News. Good morning, I'm Tom Trowbridge. A federal appeals court has sided with a former New Mexico police officer denying claims that he violated the rights of a woman and her children when he shot at their minivan as they fled. The ruling came Wednesday in the case of Oriana Farrell, who was pulled over for speeding and leading officers on a high-speed pursuit through Taos in 2013. Farrell was originally charged with aggravated fleeing, child abuse, and drug paraphernalia possession, but ended up reaching a plea agreement. She was sentenced to probation and community service. The appeals court found that Elias Montoya, the officer who fired at the van, should have been granted summary judgment by a lower court. Montoya argued he had qualified immunity, which shields public officials from legal actions unless their conduct was unreasonable in light of clearly established law. Santa Fe County's Republican Party is suing the city of Santa Fe over how much the next mayor will be paid. The New Mexican reports the county GOP, along with nine city residents, filed a lawsuit on Wednesday in state district court. The suit claims the city's independent salary commission that earlier this year set the annual mayoral base pay at $110,000 a year had no authority to do so. The plaintiffs argue the city's voters in 2014 approved the mayoral pay boost to $74,000 a year. That same vote included changes to the mayor's position, making it full-time. The current mayoral salary is just under $30,000 a year. State prosecutors say a former business office manager at an Albuquerque rehabilitation center is accused of using her position to steal thousands of dollars from three elderly patients at the facility. Court records show Leanne Bennett was indicted by a grand jury this week on three counts of exploiting a resident's property and numerous charges relating to the unauthorized use of debit cards. Investigators say Bennett is accused of gaining access to one resident's checking account and the debit cards of two other residents. She allegedly wrote several checks to herself and made multiple withdrawals. Defense attorney John Seymour described Bennett as a good woman and said he had not yet seen any of the evidence against his client. According to the indictment, the charges stem from 2012 and 2013. And as the new year approaches, KSFR News takes a look back at some of the top stories in New Mexico of 2017. With Susana Martinez wrapping up her final term as governor, the race to replace her has set off a game of musical chairs. Republican Steve Pierce and Democrat Michelle Lujan Grisham declined to seek re-election to Congress so they could run for governor. And an open Albuquerque-based congressional seat has drawn a long list of candidates, including former state Democratic Party chairwoman Deborah Holland and former U.S. Attorney Damon Martinez. The race in New Mexico's southern district includes former Hobbs Mayor Monty Newman and state lawmaker Yvette Harrell. Hundreds of pages of court records related to sexual abuse allegations against clergy members were made public in response to an order from a New Mexico judge. It marked the largest disclosure of such records since people began suing the Archdiocese of Santa Fe nearly three decades ago. Church officials say they hope the disclosure and publication of a list of clergy accused of sexual misconduct would serve as an additional step in healing for victims, their families, and parishioners. Weather-wise, Santa Fe's expecting mostly sunny skies today, the high reaching 54. Tonight, clear skies, the overnight low 30. Tomorrow, sunny skies with Friday's high 56. I'm Tom Trowbridge, KSFR News.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is proud to support KSFR and the Santa Fe community. Established in Santa Fe in 1976, Rothstein Donatelli also has offices in Albuquerque and Tempe. The firm provides representation in Native American law, professional licensure, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights cases nationwide. More information is available at their website, RothsteinLaw.com.
Support comes from Santa Fe Pro Musica, continuing its 36th season with award-winning violinist Benjamin Beilman and the Pro Musica Orchestra in Love the Magician, a program exploring the many facets of love on Friday, December 29th at the Lenzic. The concert includes the music of Manuel de Falla, Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, and a moving tribute to Bernstein by Aaron Stern. Tickets and more information at sfpromusica.org.
And welcome back to KSFR's Wake Up Call, 23 minutes now before 9 o'clock.
If not now, when? If not the curmudgeon, who? Soon on KSFR.
Several New Mexico state parks are offering an invigorating way to begin your new year, and it's all free. I spoke this week with Christina Cordova. She's the communications coordinator with the New Mexico State Parks.
Tom, we're excited to host another year. This is our sixth year in a row that we've been hosting First Day Hikes throughout 13 of our state parks throughout New Mexico. So we have parks in the south, parks in the east, parks in the west, and parks in the north that are celebrating New Year's Day with a First Day Hike and also some polar bear plunges into the lakes.
Now, if you would, Christina, tell us about those polar bear plunges. I noticed they're all in the northeast part of the state.
In the northeast, yes.
Why is that?
Why is that? Well, because the water is extremely cold. And those parks, you know, going back to Story Lake State Park in Las Vegas, New Mexico, they've been jumping into the lake on New Year's Day for 22 years. That's a long-standing tradition there. And that was founded by former Magistrate Judge Philip Romero, and we want to give a shout-out to those folks in Las Vegas for coming up with this cool event for the community to come out. And it's just a challenge. I guess it's a personal challenge for people to see if they have that courage to jump into that cold, icy lake. And the parks that are hosting it are Sugary Canyon State Park up near Raton, Story Lake in Las Vegas, and also Eagle Nest Lake State Park will be hosting polar bear plunges on New Year's Day.
And Christina, the First Day Hikes, tell us about that tradition and what that's all about.
Well, that's a National Association of State Park Directors initiative through America State Parks, and that originated over 20 years ago. So New Mexico State Parks, like I said earlier, have been participating over the last 6 years. And it's just a way to get folks out in the great outdoors and maybe burn off some of those calories over the holiday and spend some quality family time together out in a state park. They are guided hikes, so there will be rangers on these hikes explaining all the cultural resources and all the beauty that New Mexico State Parks has to offer. Any questions you have around the surrounding areas, our park rangers, our interpretive rangers, are very knowledgeable of their parks and of their community.
Now we have, I think, what you mentioned, 33 state parks across New Mexico?
34 state parks.
34, okay.
Yes.
So of those 34, a good percentage of them are offering these first day hikes as well as the plunges.
Yes.
That's great participation to get folks to work on their day off.
Right. You know, state parks is a 365-day business. I mean, we never close. Really, I mean, most of our parks right now do have still camping available. We're year-round parks, so our employees that are dedicated and willing to work these special events on these holiday weekends, starting Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, and into the new year. So I, you know, give a shout-out to our dedicated employees out in the parks that are willing to come out and host these great special events for folks to enjoy. And it's free. These 13 state parks will be free. The day use fees, which are generally $5 to get into the park, will be waived at these 13 state parks for this event only on New Year's Day.
That's a great way to start the year, isn't it?
So, you know, Tom, it's affordable. New Mexico State Parks generates our own money at the gate. The people that come in our visitation lists how much revenue we get for the parks. We don't get much general funding, so whatever we generate at the park is by the folks that come visit. So our staff members try to get creative and do some fun events for family, you know, to come out and spend some quality time together that's affordable. And really, in anywhere in New Mexico, you're no more than 45 minutes away from a state park, wherever you're at.
Christina, the first day hike at Elephant Butte Dam, the dam is only open that one day to pedestrians.
It's only open that one day, Tom. Yes, it is. And, you know, hundreds of people go. Last year, I believe they had 700 people come over on First Day Hikes because they wanted to walk over the Centennial Dam. Elephant Butte Dam celebrated its 100th year last year. So we had over 700 people come out and walk over that dam, and that's only open to pedestrians on New Year's Day for this first day hike.
Christina, these first day hikes, I understand, originated more than about two decades ago in Massachusetts. What is kind of the underlying message of the first day hikes for New Year's Day at the New Mexico State Parks?
Well, getting kids outdoors and unplugging from video games and other electronic media, and trying to get people to promote physical fitness and come out and enjoy a nice day. We've had such beautiful weather here in New Mexico. I'm not certain what the weather predictions are for New Year's Day, a week away from today, but we will be, you know, having these events, and we do sponsor events, like I mentioned, year-round. We have very cool events at all our parks year-round.
And Christina, if you would tell us a little bit about the diversity of New Mexico State Parks and their various locations throughout the state.
Well, there's various terrains throughout the state, obviously, and we have the coal mines up at Sugary Canyon State Park. We have the Dinosaur Trackway, which is world-renowned, in Clayton Lake State Park, so most folks don't know about that northeast corner of the state. But we have the greatest dinosaur tracks in North America at Clayton Lake State Park. So there's a variety of things that folks can do and visit, such as Living Desert Zoo and Gardens in Carlsbad. We manage a zoo down in Carlsbad. And state parks, you know, are just beautiful throughout the entire state. If you want boating, fishing, camping, hiking, star parties, we have the gorgeous black dark skies in New Mexico. A lot of our parks have observatories where folks can come out. We have astronomers that volunteer their time to come out and teach people about the constellations. So it's very educational programs that we try to promote. First day hikes especially is just to get folks to get outdoors and do some physical fitness.
And, Christina, those polar bear plunges sound kind of scary to this guy anyway. what have you heard about those? Have you ever done one?
No, I've never done one, Tom, and I don't ever wish to. I see the photographs, and we do have rangers in the water. So they're jumping into maybe 4 or 5 feet is the deepest there off the docks. But we do have rangers on hand that are trained in cold water immersion, and you know, luckily, knock on wood, we've been good all these years hosting these polar bear plunges. No one's gotten hurt, and it's a lot of fun for everyone, and a lot of onlookers come just to watch people jump into the lake.
Christina, what else should we know about these great events taking place on New Year's Day?
Folks can get online, Tom, at nmparks.com, and we upload our event calendar every day. There's always a new event happening at one of our parks. We also list all our events on New Mexico Tourism Department's website, newmexico.org. You can check out our events there. We're on recreational.gov. There's numerous ways folks can find out what's happening at state parks, but generally nmparks.com will give them the information they need.
Christina Cordova, Communications Director with the New Mexico State Parks Division. Fourteen minutes now in front of 9 o'clock at KSFR's Wake Up Call. There's an incredible amount of sports on TV these days. Yes, it is the holiday season, and of course the professional athletes are making money, lots of it. With that in mind, though, we now hear a deeper look at the struggle unpaid college athletes face to succeed on and off the basketball court. Being a student athlete may look glamorous from the outside, but Matthew Moyer shows us how many of these athletes have to work extra hard off the court to make sure they're able to succeed on the court.
Kai Feldman is a basketball player for the Syracuse men's basketball team, whose biggest challenge takes place off the court.
It's pretty tough, you know, balancing academics and being a student athlete. Just kind of time management and learning how to balance both kind of takes a while, but it's all right.
Thousands of college athletes across the country struggle to manage both academics and sports. 77% of NCAA men's basketball players graduate, leaving close to 25% of the student-athletes who never quite earn that degree.
You have to sacrifice something sometimes in order to get what you want to get out of your prospective sport.
Alan Griffin was once a student-athlete for Syracuse, who is now on the flip side of things as an assistant men's basketball coach. Griffin says it's very hard for athletes who are tempted by the same distractions as every student on campus.
So I would say socially you have to kind of pick and choose, you know, what you want to do and also still have time to doing it. But, you know, sometimes instead of doing it, you know, 2 hours, you may have to do it an hour and a half.
Time management can be especially difficult for student athletes with all the traveling and time that goes along with athletics.
Yeah, it's a huge time commitment. The toughest thing probably is being on the road, just because, you know, when you're here, as long as you manage your time well, you can kind of figure it out, and, you know, you got tutors and stuff to help you. But when you're on the road, it means you're missing class, and it's just kind of hard to replace being in class. It doesn't matter really how hard you work or how well you manage your time, you're still a little bit of a disadvantage because you're gone so long.
Academic advisors are a huge help to the organization, time management, and success of the student-athletes. Katie Scanlon is the academic advisor of the Syracuse men's basketball team and thinks student-athletes do not get enough credit.
I think that balance is one of the things that a lot of people outside of athletics don't understand. A lot of people, fans or things like that, they only see kind of the glamorous side of college athletics. They don't see all the hard work that students put in on a day-to-day basis, the 6 a.m. workouts and the late nights cramming for exams that they didn't get to study for because they spent 5 hours on their sport that day or something like that. So I think it's definitely challenging. It produces a lot of students who are really, really good at time management and prioritizing by the time that they're done, but it's a hard life lesson, I think, when they're in the moment.
Katie travels with the team, which can be a huge help for the student-athletes when they are on the road. Whenever players need specific help with their studies, there are tutors available at all times.
She can get us a tutor for a certain class or subject, or maybe it's just a certain exam we need to study for, and then that'll just be somebody that comes in and works with us.
In an effort to try to give student-athletes more time for their academic studies, the NCAA instituted a new rule this year that gives athletes an additional 14 days off. Kai Feldman said that these 14 days can be very beneficial for student-athletes going forward.
The extra 14 days is huge. Any off day is kind of just a chance to regroup, both physically on the athletic side. You obviously take care of your body, maybe get some more sleep. But then academically, if you fell behind the last few days because of traveling or games or something like that, it's kind of just a day where you can, A, catch up, and make sure you're all set, and B, kind of start looking ahead and preparing for, you know, the next busy week and kind of planning your schedule.
That planning doesn't end until the sports season ends, and even then some. But Kai Feldman and the rest of the basketball players at Syracuse University and other college athletes say they couldn't manage it all without a helping hand, with the rigorous requirements of being a student-athlete.
Yeah, it's definitely tough being a student-athlete, but with the help, you know, the NCAA has given us now and the tutors and the academic advisors, they definitely make it possible to still graduate.
Kai Feldman says next spring, his days as a college athlete will be over, and he will leave Syracuse with his diploma. I'm Matthew Moyer.
Nine minutes now in front of 9 o'clock at KSFR's wake-up call. Let's check in now with National Native News.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Four Nebraska beer stores that closed last spring are fighting a state assessment that they owe hundreds of thousands of dollars in underreported state taxes and fees. The Lincoln Journal-Star reports the four stores that once operated on the edge of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation dispute the State Department of Revenue claim that they owe a combined $600,000 in unpaid taxes over 3 years. It's the latest setback for the stores that once operated in the tiny town of White Clay, Nebraska, but were forced to close after concerns they fueled problems for the reservation where alcohol is banned. Physical activity is often included in Native stories and ceremonies. Today, health experts say sedentary ways are contributing to high rates of obesity and diabetes in Indian Country. Some fitness experts and enthusiasts are working to bring resources and support to help Native people with their health concerns. This week we are highlighting our USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism series, and today we look at two border towns in the Southwest to explore some grassroots efforts.
Always make sure you get a nice warm-up first.
Pax Harvey explains some exercises as he belts out reps in a gym located in the reservation border town of Gallup, New Mexico. The advocate, comedian, and business development specialist says he uses fitness as a way to heal from trauma and handle everyday stresses. The Navajo powerlifting competitor mentors others by encouraging them to make positive choices, saying he was once immersed in negativity.
A lot of violence, drugs, and alcohol was very heavy. I was 9 years old when my dad took his life.
Harvey says he never sugarcoats the dysfunction of his childhood. Weightlifting became an outlet for his struggles with pain, frustration, and anger.
About 2 years ago, I became a powerlifting champion, World Cup champion, and national champion. And I started to help individuals and people that step into the weight room.
Some research suggests that people who believe they can lose weight are more likely to find success. Having role models may be a key component in building that confidence, says Brenda Charlie. She's a fitness coach in the city of Flagstaff, Arizona, more than 180 miles west of Gallup. Charlie has a degree in physical education, but says her interest in exercise started at a young age.
I grew up watching my parents. They were runners, and they liked to ride their cycles all the time. I grew up with my parents modeling exercise.
Charlie, who's Navajo, works in both tribal communities and in Flagstaff at the Wellness Center run by Native Americans for Community Action, and says a fitness community with professionals can offer encouragement, obtainable goals, and knowledge. Didi Koyakaptiwa, who's Hopi, is among those who say they found community support at the Wellness Center.
I came from a family with diabetes, and of course, I'm right there if I don't take care of myself.
So she's going to kind of lead us.
Back in Gallup, Pax Harvey and a group of friends do bodyweight exercises. His fitness community stretches across Indian country as he makes time for the gym when traveling for work.
Whatever you learn in a weight room doesn't just apply in a weight room. It can also apply outside in the real world.
Changing the health of Native communities will take more than just grassroots and individual efforts, says Dr. John Molina. He's with Native Health in Phoenix and has worked with Indian Health Service clinics in Alaska and urban health centers in Arizona.
We cannot work in silos anymore. I think if we're going to really improve the health care of our people, we have to come together as a community, of entities who provide health care for our people. So grassroots efforts that take place to improve our health, either through eating or exercise or activities, they really need to connect with these other entities, tribal and urban and IHS facilities, to say, how can we work together?
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, consistency, goals, and a support system are keys to losing weight and maintaining healthy habits. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism's MA in Social Journalism, rethinking journalism as a community service. Application deadline is January 5th at journalism.cuny.edu. Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And this is KSFR's wake-up call, 4 minutes now before 9 o'clock. Earth-like planets are being discovered circling the most common type of star in our neighborhood of the Milky Way galaxy. Al Grauer has more.
Astronomers continue to be delighted when they discover an Earth-sized planet. Scientists were thus very disappointed when the red dwarf star hosting the nearest such planet, Proxima b, some 4.2 light years away, turns out to have the nasty habit of emitting bursts of radiation which are likely to sterilize and or remove the atmospheres of its family of planets. Recently, hope of finding a nearby Earth was rekindled when scientists at the European Southern Observatory in Chile discovered a small planet circling what appears to be a quiet, well-behaved red dwarf star 11 light-years from us. Astronomers are not yet sure that this newly discovered Earth-sized planet lies within its star's habitable zone, where liquid water could exist on its surface. Jumping the gun, ET enthusiasts have beamed a friendly message in the direction of another nearby red dwarf planet system. Their target, the super-Earth planet GJ273b, is located some 12.4 light-years away near the bright star Sirius in the constellation of Canis Major. At this distance, a civilization on GJ273b could have already received a picture of humanity by deciphering I Love Lucy and other TV signals it has been picking up for 50 years or so. The next generation of very large telescopes will allow astronomers to search for the presence of oxygen and other molecules, which indicate the presence of life in the atmospheres of nearby worlds. In the meantime, we have more reasons to be thankful for what we have here on planet Earth. For Travelers in the Night, this is Dr. Al Grauer. Go to travelersinthenight.org, program 417, for more information.
And that does it for Thursday's Wake Up Call. Thanks to our guests and contributors today, Christina Cordova, Ellen Lockyer, Matthew Moyer, and Al Grauer. Tune in for Wake Up Call tomorrow, Friday, when Ellen Lockyer will be your host. And stay tuned to KSFR News on the hour throughout the day. I'm Tom Trowbridge. Goodbye for now.